the time for the sunset prayer. By the way, welcome. Have we met?
No, yeah. No.
What's your name?
Douglas.
Welcome, Douglas.
Thank you.
And this is George, who's also here for the first time tonight, who we met on a plane flying to Louisville and met him again yesterday by accident walking past our house and had an unlikely conversation, and here he is. So we have each month we have a theme that we work with, and it's a new month. Last Thursday was the new month, and the theme is the body is a servant, train it with love. And the salat, the evening prayer we're about to do, is an act of servanthood. It's also connecting to that same space we just connected to within ourselves, that same dimensionless, transcendent, immanent reality that is our source, our home, our nature. That's what we worship and that's what we serve. Can't see Matthew. Matthew's hiding behind. Just move over it a little bit so we can... You know, typically, we used to in California and elsewhere, we met in a yurt, a pretty large yurt, and people sat in a circle. The tradition is to sit in the circle. But there's some people that just love the back row, like to be... it would be ideal if we could fill up this space.
You want to bring your chair around, Rebecca? Can you see it?
A little... Make a circle of energy.
Okay. Now we have to get Jonathan.
It's okay, Jonathan, you're cool.
We may have some tragedies up here too. So,
You know, yeah, pull the chair up there. This is so much better, isn't this? Doesn't that feel already nice? Mm-hmm. And they say that, you know, dervishes wear some fabric off of their knees, but even more so they wear the fabric off of their, you know, elbows being close to each other. And here's a few more we'll have to fit in.
Hello.
Good.
Thank you.
Welcome.
Welcome.
There's the hassock.
It's okay. We'll bring some dining chairs.
Good.
We're practicing making a circle.
Oh,
well, to the best of our ability. So.
Actually, I can just sit on the floor.
No.
Well, that's good. That's actually great. Yes. If you're comfortable, then give her a pillow, too, or something.
It's all working out.
Yeah, anybody who ever wants to sit on the floor is more than welcome. It's you have larger pillows. Yes, Kasa. Now you have to come.
Now that we gave him to get
you. Yeah. The priority is to be as close as possible and to be in as much of a circle as possible. That's already, isn't that better? It's good. So I mentioned the theme, and I also made a nice little picture for us to look at tonight. Because I realized after last week that sometimes the metaphysical basis of our work, sometimes it's, well, we're in the process of learning. So let's, hopefully there'll be enough of these to go around. Started out small and we're growing. Let's see how that goes, actually. Because we're considering the body this month, and relationship with the body, and what is this relationship? What are we relating from and what are we relating to? So, if you look at the first three items, going from the top down, envision a line going through them. The top little thing there. It's a little star, actually. Pure spirit, infinite, containing all qualities and attributes. And the next, the heart. The heart, relatively infinite, subtle, subconscious, and superconscious mind, perceives qualities, the true center of the human being, mediates between spirit and self, or the I. So as you can see, the heart is right there in the middle. And right down below, that I, big I. Sometimes that's all we know, is that I. But, you know, last week we were talking and there was a good sense that there was a bit of lack of clarity about what is a human being and what is this body. And really fundamental psycho-spiritual concepts are not given to us by our culture. And yet, different traditions will have a different model of what of the spiritual nature of the human being. And actually, there's quite a bit of consistency through many of the traditions, I would say, through the Hellenic, Hermetic, Hellenic, Judeo-Christian, Islamic, Sufic tradition. There's quite a bit of consistency in the categories and how we understand the human being. And actually, we can add to that the Vedic concept, not that different. So very simply, what's being proposed here, what we are, what you are, what I am, is a pole, an axis running through many levels of reality, from coarse to fine, from material to absolutely subtle. And at one end of this pole is this I, and by that I we mean a sense of self, a sense of I-ness, which can vary quite a bit, human being to human being. And then at the other pole of our existence, somewhere in absolute non-existence, is the spirit pole of human individuality. And right in the middle, somewhere there in the middle, is heart, a mediating capacity, something that in the way is very close to us. It's in some ways it's our inner life, it's the essence of our inner, true inner life, and it's in that space of the heart that we might find and know that dimensionless point of spirit represented by the top blue star there. So it's quite a simple conception. It gets more complicated when we get down to the I and what's really going on there. What is that all about, this thing we call I, our sense of I-ness? Because rarely is our sense of I-ness something pure and simple. More often, it's composed of whatever our body, thoughts, and emotions are telling us. And take any one of those. Any one of those is very complex. Our thoughts. We have thoughts about who we are, what people have told us, what people expect of us, our cultural conditioning and expectations. So much in the thought realm, it's both cultural, familial, religious, even. And then in the emotional realm, oh, wow, big, big department of like and dislike, self-esteem, shame, self-importance, self-worthlessness. And then with the body, we have a body too. And, well, DNA and all that that brings, our electrochemical system, each of us in absolute individual as far as our bodily makeup and predilections go. And a sense of I-ness comes also through the body, because we feel certain things, we experience certain things. If somebody shoots you with an arrow, you say, ouch, I'm hurt. And positive, negative feelings, through the sensations, through the body. So, we're talking about this month, the body as a servant, train it with love. That's just one little aspect of this diagram. And then, by the way, at the very bottom is a bringing it all together with the eye and a transparent heart. And you haven't seen it yet. And the little point of spirit there and settled in the heart. This is the human being, something like this, that we could be if we were whole, if we were conscious on all of these levels. And that also is a proposal that we're meant to be aware on all of these levels. We're meant to know ourselves as connected to pure spirit. We're meant to know ourselves as hearts that are capable of relationship. It's another key feature of the heart, that it is the organ of relationship, the instrument of relationship. The heart is also that which senses existence qualitatively, senses what it is to be a mortal human being in the world of time, senses what it is to be partly a mammal on this earth, a mammal with spirit, senses beauty, senses meaning. And in Sufi teaching, the heart is practically God. Rumi says as much. He says it very clearly. Because the heart is relatively infinite. It's not just some little seat of our emotions. It is literally an entryway into an infinite universe. Why else would it be said, as it's said in our tradition, God says, the heavens and the earth do not contain me. Only the heart of my faithful servant is expansive enough to contain me. If you search for me there. So that vast qualitative reality is in us. It's, and we are it. It is in us the way a hologram would be in us. The hologram of the whole universe, not just the physical universe, but the spiritual universe, the universe of meaning. Every divine name and quality is in your heart, at least in potential, as a hidden treasure. Hidden treasure has been deposited in your name. You don't have to beg for it. It's been given to you by the most generous source. You just need to know how it's activated. And its activation depends on a quality of relationship to that source. We could call that relationship, describe it as being a relationship of sincerity, a relationship of humility, of love, but also of consciousness, of a capacity for attention, of intentionality that yearns to be in alignment with that source. So, coming back down to where we are here in this humble task of the body as a servant, train it with love. One of the beautiful things of the Sufi tradition is what we just did, this very embodied form of practice, of worship. And what we mean by worship is reverence for the sacred, for the infinite, for the source. And the body acknowledging that reverence with every cell. Communion with that dimensionless point that is essentially within our own heart, but it being dimensionless also means that it's nowhere and everywhere. It's located in that no thing out of which everything emanates. And our worship is the worship of that. Our service is the service of that. Our love is the love of that. And then we try to actualize it. One of the beautiful things about Sufi tradition is that we have these embodied practices that are done both individually, and as you know, can be done anywhere, just by defining the sacred space and its orientation. Doesn't need to be done in any particular place other than a place that is clean. And the postures remind us of different states of being, of the state of human dignity, of the state of servanthood, of the state of surrender. And even prior to that, which we haven't mentioned, is the ablution that precedes it. Also very much an objective fact of our bodiliness. And it's assumed when we come to a meeting like this that we've already taken care of that, that we've done our ablutions, that we arrive in a state of ritual purity. If not, there's bathrooms here. If you don't know what that is, you can find it easily described either on our website in the section on Salat or easily anywhere on the internet. But the interesting thing about ablution is that before prayer, or ideally, a dervish is in a state of ablution all the time, as much as possible. What breaks it, as you know, is going to the bathroom or falling asleep for an extended period of time or anything that, when there's some emission from the body, including bleeding, requires a refreshing of ablution. But what's going on here is a cleansing with fresh, cool water, which is not only a physical, or shall we say, not only a liquid purification, but an electromagnetic purification as well, where the sensitive areas of the body, the hands, forearms, the face, ears, top of the head, the feet, are ritually cleansed with fresh, pure water. I discovered something really interesting just this week that's, I'm amazed I didn't really get it before. But I sometimes suffer from restless leg syndrome, especially on airplanes and or sitting in a theater, and it's really, really something. It's really annoying, you know, it's just you sort of have to move. It's like creepy crawlies on your feet. Anybody who's suffered with this knows it can be torture on a long flight. What I realized this week is that if I go and do ablutions and run cold water over my feet, especially if I stand in the shower and ground myself in the iron bathtub, it takes care of it. So there's something about grounding. And this is also, we're talking about the body tonight. I know a doctor, and PhD in biophysics, who's also an esoteric scientist. And I recently heard him talking about that one of the most important things that we can do at this time for our general well-being is simply to take off our shoes and stand on the earth, stand in the grass. And right, we've been doing that around here. We've been just going out there where there's a little bit of grass, taking off our shoes and just standing there. Another kind of grounding. And when the ritual prayer was first taught, first revealed, of course, people were doing these prostrations on the ground, literally on the ground, most of the time. And now people live in apartment buildings, and they're flying around in airplanes for days at a time, getting very ungrounded. So these ancient revealed practices, which can be approached in many different ways and be done for many different reasons, if done with sincerity, with love, and with awareness, also bring certain objective results that are seem to be very helpful for maintaining the state that we wish to maintain. And one of the most important practices, I think, those of us who came to this tradition and weren't born into it, I would say, without a doubt, I think most of us agree that ablution is one of the absolute most important practices we've learned. And it's called the key to prayer. As important as prayer or worship is, ablution is the key to prayer. And once you've learned it and experienced it, you experience it as like there was a time in my life before ablutions and the time in my life after ablutions. The two different eras of life. You begin to sense the need for it. You begin to sense when you've let it go too long, and or have neglected that purification and that grounding. So these are just, I'm just touching on some really basic things, because we've never talked about some of these things with some of you. It's beautiful the way the tradition of Sufism is grounded in these practical matters. And when I say grounded, I make a distinction between being earthbound, which is not being grounded, but being grounded in the sense of connecting all of these levels and aware of these higher, subtler levels within your own being, but then bringing them to earth in various ways, in worship. Touching our foreheads to the ground is one of those ways. Let me also remind you that in our book, Living Presence, there's a chapter called The Mysteries of the Body. I urge you to read that chapter, which goes a bit more thoroughly into some of these things than we can do here, but which will, I think, be helpful. And in that chapter, as I mentioned, a journalist that I met, well, he was once a journalist, who went to Russia, and in Russia witnessed, he was a journalist from New England, he went to Russia and he witnessed the Orthodox practice of prostration in a Russian church. And it was unlike anything he'd ever seen in his life before. But it made such an impression on him, an impression beyond words, because there were no words to describe it, that it actually was the cause of him entering a monastery and becoming a monk. Interesting. Um, the prostration is an archetypal human posture. Ah, yes. And I'll just briefly touch on a final theme and subject which we'll come back to next week, inshallah. And that is, in our Mevlevi tradition, and in all Sufi traditions, but in Mevlevi tradition it's very, very strong. One could even say, and I've heard it said, that it is the most essential practice of Rumi's tradition. Adab, spiritual courtesy. A very subtle matter. We have a paper on this on the website. If you go, and I encourage you strongly to do this. Actually, I made some copies of it tonight. I have about 10 copies here. So if you haven't read this, it's called Adab, the Courtesy of the Path. It's just two pretty long pages. This attempts to describe it as much as it can be described. But it's a way of being, it's a way of living with respect, it's a way of knowing that when you step across the threshold into sacred space, that you're in a different space. And that there is a different standard than perhaps we meet with in the outer world, but we hope to carry it into the outer world as well. It's a way of paying attention. It's a way of honoring and respecting both the physical and the human world. It's in the language of the path, the way things are spoken. It's in something as simple as when a Sufi takes a glass of water, he or she may kiss the glass before drinking, or before putting on a cloak. The same thing, everything. And dressing for a ritual like the whirling ceremony, every article of clothing that goes on is done with a particular intention. And it's in how we serve tea. It's in how we eat, how we drink, how we the respect we show each other. And it's best learned from human beings who have matured in that quality of adab. And I myself am still learning. After quite a few years, I'm learning. I'm learning from Camille. I'm learning from the members of Rumi's family, who some of you will meet in Turkey and have met, who are extraordinary examples of this quality. And I sometimes tell the story about how years ago, when I was in a gathering of about half a dozen or so Western sheikhs of traditional Sufi orders, which was a very small group at the time, different orders, not Mevlevis, and someone asked the question, well, what's the most important thing we've learned from the path? And within minutes, everyone agreed the most important thing we learned from the Sufi path was adab, spiritual courtesy. Interesting. Hardly needed a discussion. But then we did discuss. We said, well, why? And basically the answer was, because this made so many other things possible. It engendered respect. It engendered trust. It awakened a kind of consciousness. Now, I'm bringing this into the subject of tonight, which is the body is a servant. Train it with love. This also is what adab is. Remembering your servanthood in the world of bodies. It's an aspect of educating this bottom feature we call I here. You know, this eye needs some education, it needs some training, it needs some edification. It needs some culture. And very different from our Western culture. When our Murshid Suleiman Dede first came to the United States, he was a man of such a huge heart and unconditional love. And he loved Americans. But he said, as an aside to one of the teachers, he said, "But please, teach them manners." And that adab is finally what it really is about, is maintaining a certain level of vibration. It's not mere formality. It's not mere form. But it's a quality of being that that makes transformation possible. That creates an atmosphere in which transformation is possible. So any thoughts or any questions, any observations or contributions?
Archetypal nature of frustration, of what happens in one's body when they're going to need to be reflected.
I'll tell it this. I'll start with a story. Camille and I used to do some teaching with a woman named Helen Palmer, who was a great teacher of the Enneagram. And she always wanted to have a sort of partner teaching with her, either someone who was a master of the physical and martial arts, or someone who was in the department of the heart. And we were that department of the heart. So she said, "Well, Kabir and Camille, you come and teach heart practices with me." We were doing a week-long training at Esalen in California. And I was introducing simple zikrs, and at a certain point in the week I said to the collected group, "Would you like to experience some archetypal postures?" And everybody said, "Oh, that sounds really good." So basically I asked men and women to line up, as we did today, women on one side, men on the other side, and rows of eight, and there were about 80 people. And then we went through these postures, and I said the first posture, standing, is the meditative posture of human dignity and responsibility. The second, the bow, is the posture of servanthood. Feel your servanthood to all of life and to humanity and to the divine. The third posture, the forehead touching the ground, is the posture of surrender. And then you come back to a kneeling position, regathering, integrating, and then you do a second prostration, which is surrender of surrender, the effacement of effacement, in which the heart is higher than the head at that point. And in which you're also very close to a embryonic, you know, the posture, the shape of an embryo, a little bit like that, which is has its own energetic properties. So anyway, we did it with the group, and this group was there were kind of a lot of clinicians, therapists, and corporate kind of people. Nice corporate people, but corporate-type people. And after doing this practice, people were coming up to me for days saying, "Oh, you know, Kabir, this is just what the corporate world needs. And to we do this on our own. And a lot of these people, majority of them probably had never ever touched their forehead to the ground. So it's a hugely powerful experience in the beginning. And in fact, it can deepen. It's the key to everything. Just that posture. Entering the effacement of prostration where the self is effaced in the infinite, consciously. I say it's archetypal because it does occur across all traditions that I know of. You know, maybe there's some tradition somewhere where it doesn't use it, but I don't know what that is. Especially when you include all three postures, standing, bowing, and the prostration. But the prostration is the quintessence of it. Allows the cells of the body to remember. You know, as if the body really longs for that, longs to be in that remembrance. But the body is only in remembrance when the heart and mind are also in that state. Which is the whole key to this theme, isn't it? I mean, the body is a servant, train it with love. I could say train it with awareness. Would that be as complete? Is there ever love without awareness? There's awareness without love. But is there ever love without awareness? Love engenders awareness. Two people fall in love and they just can't help looking at each other. The mystic falls in love too. Can't help looking at God with the eye of the heart. So for myself, this task started out very humbly, very simply. As I said, I started with a personal trainer at the gym this week. The body is the servant, train it with love. And I learned a few simple things, some gentle exercises and practices, and a little bit of intentionality in regard to the body was awakened through this theme. That's one aspect of it. And we can be more intentional about how we treat our bodies, what we do with them. We can also be more reverent towards our bodies, kinder towards our bodies, and sometimes more disciplined with our bodies. But the point is, all of this is coming from a higher consciousness. It's not coming out of some desperate, egoistic need to diet and look good, you know, or to gain strength and power over others. It may also be just to accept ourselves and even our bodily limitations, which each of us must face. You know, a woman who is pregnant has to face the limitations of and beauty of being pregnant. People who are entering their late 60s have other issues to deal with. Young people have the issues of youth to deal with. In a relationship with this vehicle that has hunger and thirst, pleasure and pain, and many subtler things as well. subtle and beautiful impressions that, and wisdom that also comes from and through the body. Why is it that there are people whose bodies become light, literally, radiate light. There are people whose bodies become light, light enough to float in the air. There are people whose bodies can appear in more than one place at the same time. These people who have such attributes are not usually athletes, by the way. They're not people who are focused on the training of the body. More often, they're people who are focused on the training of the soul. And something reflects in the body. We know of many cases, personally, of some of our teachers whose bodies didn't decay. And in Tibet, there are literally thousands and thousands of interesting phenomena of monks who died and their bodies just become nothing and burst into light. There are tens of thousands of those on record in Tibet. Sufis just tend to smell like roses for 700 years. So there's a lot going on here with this donkey we call the body and this beautiful vehicle we call the body. Let us remember, honor it, sanctify it, respect it, and train it. Rumi says, we have created the body. The body hasn't created us. We've created the body as bees make the luminous honeycomb.